This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Documentary films have played a surprisingly large role in this presidential campaign. Today and tomorrow, we'll hear from the people behind two of these films. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the director of George W. Bush, Faith in the White House, a movie in praise of what the film describes as Bush's faith-based presidency. Today we hear from Michael Moore. His film Fahrenheit 9/11, which is very critical of the Bush presidency, is the highest-grossing documentary of all time and one of the most controversial. It was just released on DVD and video. Moore had expected his film to be shown on pay-per-view cable the night before the election, but the company canceled the program, and according to the Associated Press, Moore is considering taking legal action against the company, which he accused of caving into pressure from, quote, top Republican people. Moore has been touring the country in support of John Kerry, trying to convince young people to register to vote. He has two new books, Will They Ever Trust Us Again?, Letters from the War Zone, and The Official Fahrenheit 9/11 Reader. We recorded our interview last Thursday. Let me ask you, when you made Fahrenheit 9/11, were you thinking, I am making this movie to defeat President Bush?
No. In fact, when we started, I had no idea, and this is always true with a documentary, when the thing would be done. Sometimes films like this take years. And, my initial motivation was just I thought that there should be a record of how this administration behaved after 3,000 people were killed on September 11th and how they used this tragic event to justify their actions. When we started making this, there was no Kerry versus Bush or, anything like that. And we didn't know even if it would get done before the election. So
let me ask you about one of the most talked about scenes from Fahrenheit 9/11. And this is the scene in which, President Bush is, on September 11th, is sitting in a Florida elementary school classroom listening to the students read from the book My Pet Goat. As he's sitting and listening, his chief of staff walks in to tell him that the second plane has attacked the World Trade Center and that America is under attack. The president continues to sit in the chair for another 7 minutes listening to the children read from the book. Where did you get the footage from showing President Bush in that classroom?
We just called up the school. We're just sitting around one day, and we'd only really seen the edited version, which the country has seen over and over since September 11th. Andrew Card comes in the classroom, whispers in the president's ear. He looks immediately concerned, and then cut. That's what we've seen for 3 years. And I got to thinking, geez, I wonder what's after the cut. And so we called up the school thinking, big event like this, the school somebody must have videotaped it. And they said, oh, yes, absolutely. We set up our little home video camera, and we said, well, could we have a copy of the tape? Oh, yes, of course. It's a school property. It's open to the public. Pay $5 for the tape and, the cost of it, and we'll make you a copy. And that's how we got it.
Did they know who you were, and did they have any idea what the film you were making would look like?
Well, we didn't know what the film we were making would look like, ultimately. So, but yes, we say who we are. And I remember at the time when we made the call, it's a school in a predominantly African-American part of town there in Sarasota. And people were very friendly and very willing to, share the tape with us.
President Bush sits in the chair for about 7 minutes while the children finish reading. And you show, maybe 45 seconds of that or a minute. It's not, mm-hmm. I don't think it's more than that.
No, it isn't. We had an earlier version of the film where we put 5 minutes of him sitting there. And I got to tell you, it was so painful to watch this. It seemed almost, it was just unbearable. Imagine sitting in the middle of this film, and now for 5 minutes you're going to see him sit there like a deer in headlights. And I thought, we'll make the point by just doing a basic, sort of a time lapse here. And I don't know. It's just, I don't... as much as I don't like Bush, I also, anything else just actually seemed cruel. I think because you just sit there going, what is going on? What is going on here? You know, and, you know, we'd sit there in the edit room and somebody would say, well, maybe he's just sitting there because he wants to hear the end of the story. What happened to the goat? You know, and another person said, well, you know, there was, remember Cheney, when he was talking to Tim Russert on Meet the Press, he told Tim Russert, you know, the Secret Service immediately came in and got him in his office there in D.C., took him down to the White House basement to the Situation Room, you know, immediately went to work. And somebody said, you know, maybe they forgot about Bush. You know, and then after 6-7 minutes, somebody said, hey, he's still sitting there in that classroom. Get him out of there.
Now, part of what makes this a Michael Moore movie is that in addition to seeing this footage of President Bush sitting there, you're speaking and you're describing what may or may not be going through his mind. Let me play that excerpt from the film.
Yeah.
As Bush sat in that Florida classroom, was he wondering if maybe he should have shown up to work more often? Should he have held at least one meeting since taking office to discuss the threat of terrorism with his head of counterterrorism? Or maybe Mr. Bush was wondering why he had cut terrorism funding from the FBI. Or perhaps he just should have read the security briefing that was given to him on August 6, 2001, which said that Osama bin Laden was planning to attack America by hijacking airplanes. But maybe he wasn't worried about the terrorist threat because the title of the report was too vague.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
A report like that might make some men jump. But as in days past, George W. just went fishing.
As the minutes went by, George Bush continued to sit in the classroom. Was he thinking, I've been hanging out with the wrong crowd?
That's a scene from Fahrenheit 9/11. Michael Moore, what your critics would say is you're kind of ascribing intentions or feelings to President Bush that you have no idea if he has or not, and that you're using that moment to be very sarcastic. And I'm wondering, you know, if you have any reservations about writing that kind of copy when it's, you know, when it's the president that we're talking about, when you don't really know what's going through his mind one way or another.
Well, first of all, our founding fathers intended and hoped, because he is the president, that we feel extremely comfortable making sarcastic or satirical comments, statements or scenes or whatever about the man in charge. That's the way our whole system was set up. And in fact, satire back then was considered a legitimate form of journalism. You know, clearly, I don't think those are the things Bush, you know, was saying to himself inside of his head. I'm writing what I hope is are some lines that you know, I'm using a satirical device here. You know, to make the larger point. I don't know. Do you think I should worry whether the audience is
taking you literally?
Yeah. I always start with the assumption that the audience is pretty smart and they are sophisticated enough. And if they aren't, they'll come along and be more sophisticated.
So what impact do you think that this scene has had on people who've seen it? And it's also been shown as a clip on a lot of TV shows.
I think that it forced a lot of people to run a scenario in their own minds when they watched that scene. And I think the scenario, at least from what I hear from people and reading the email and whatever, is they sit there and they look at that scene and they imagine John F. Kennedy sitting in that classroom, or Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton or Eisenhower or maybe even Bush's dad. And the chief of staff comes in and says, sir, America is under attack. And you imagine what any of those presidents would have done. And you cannot imagine any of them sitting there for the next 7 minutes.
You've said that you didn't make the film with the idea of defeating Bush. When you started this film, you really didn't know what the shape would be. But now you are working to defeat Bush, and you're working to elect John Kerry. Do you like Kerry, or do you see Kerry as the lesser of two evils?
I've always liked Kerry. I remember as a teenager in Michigan, 1971, Kerry and the other Vietnam veterans against the war coming to Detroit to hold the what they called the Winter Soldier hearings at downtown Howard Johnson's. Yeah, this is where they took testimony from Vietnam vets about the atrocities in Vietnam. And I remember as a teenager and in the years since of thinking that this was a very courageous man. This was a man of conscience. And this was someone who has seen the horrors of war and would not wish that experience on anyone. I remember my dad saying, my dad was in the Marine Corps, the 1st Marine Division in World War II, through all those horrific battles in the South Pacific. And I remember my dad saying that when we were growing up, if you hear anybody bragging about their war experiences, don't believe them. Because anyone who's seen war, who's seen combat, never wants to talk about it again and never wants anyone else to really to have to go through that. And I believe that in John Kerry's heart exists the strong desire to never send our young men and women to battle unless it would be absolutely necessary for the defense of human life. And I've always had these feelings about him. I mean, you know, when Bush calls him the number one liberal in the Senate, I mean, he's not really telling a lie there. I mean, that's the reason he says that is because Kerry has been so good on so many of the issues, from the environment to women's rights, civil rights, et cetera, et cetera. So, this is about me feeling very good about John Kerry and a strong desire to make sure that Bush doesn't get another 4 years.
It seems to me you're in a funny spot. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Democratic Party has tried to distance themselves from you, even though you're working to register people as Democrats and to get out the vote for Kerry. Your film is so controversial, and you're such a lightning rod, and some people have accused the film of being more propaganda than documentary. So I think, you know, that those are the reasons why, you know, the party is trying to keep their distance. And I wonder how you feel about that.
No, actually, it's the other way around. I'm trying to keep my distance from them. I'm not a member of their party. I have been extremely critical of Democrats in the past for being a bunch of wusses who just kind of roll over and don't really stand up and fight for the working person in this country. And it's just a personal thing with me. I don't personally want to be connected to them or to the campaign. And in part, when he becomes president of the United States in January, you know, I see my role, my job is to keep them my camera trained on him to make sure that he does the things that need to get done. That would be a hard thing to do if I were on the bus. It's really more me that has kept the arm's length distance from the campaign.
There's something of an industry that's developed around you, devoted to attacking you. Websites, books, movies. Yeah. Do you keep up with that?
No. But I hear about it enough because I'm laughing because probably because I'm secretly enjoying it. I just literally there's in the last 6 weeks. I've heard of at least a half a dozen so-called, you know, documentaries, which are, you know, really are these tapes that various right-wing groups have put together about me. I've never heard in a six-week period of time, and they've rushed these things together, in a six-week period of time of a half a dozen documentaries being made on one subject. It's just, you know, what, I guess they're upset, you know, you know, they should be upset. The film has had an enormous impact, and it may alter the election. You know, I only have to move 1 or 2% of the people. I don't have to convince everybody with this film and with these books. I only have to move a small percentage, and if I do that, it could impact the election. They know that.
He had found out there was trouble with the pay-per-view deal shortly before we spoke.
On the way over here, I got a call saying that the pay-per-view company was receiving enormous pressure to cancel the showing of the film. And, you know, I mean, literally, I just heard this minutes ago. And, you know, I thought, when is this ever going to end with me? You know, it's just, why is it each step of the way, haven't the things I've done been successful enough, have made these people enough money to where they would just go, well, yeah, you know, the Bush White House may not like this or whatever, but damn it, we're going to make a lot of money off this guy.
Where's the pressure coming from?
They wouldn't say. You know, they're always afraid to tell me because they know that minutes later I'm going to be talking to you. And
discretion, I guess, is not your middle name.
Not when it comes to protecting those who are trying to do deals behind the curtain so that the public can't see how these decisions get made. And I'm a big believer in informing people about things like this. And so I will find out who is behind this. And and let the people know. But Terry, it is a constant struggle. And, you know, whether it was when we were trying to get the film released and, you know, Disney wouldn't release it, or I had the same problem with my book, Stupid White Men, already printed, already sitting there at the printing plant, covers on the book, everything, 50,000 copies. But it was, you know, 9/11, it was just, and, you know, they wouldn't release the book, the publisher. And it's just, I wonder at what point am I just going to go, you know, this really is just too much. And, you know, I wonder when do I burn out?
The movie Stolen Honors, which is by that Swift Boat Group, this is a movie that attacks John Kerry's record in Vietnam. That's going to be aired on stations that are part of the Sinclair group of broadcasters. Do you see any comparisons between that film being broadcast on TV? And that's been contested because, you know, critics are saying this is a political film. If you show that film, there has to be a counterpart. You know, you can't just show it as news. Do you see any comparisons between the broadcast of that film and your attempts to get your movie shown on pay-per-view?
No, because that's clearly a long-form ad against a political candidate that was done specifically for this election. My film won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. My film has broken box office records across the country. It's a movie. It has no connection to Mr. Kerry whatsoever. I've never met the man. I've never spoken to him. I've never spoken to anybody in his campaign. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a member of the Democratic Party. You know, I'm a filmmaker, and I set out to make movies that I think are an expression of you know, what's inside of me. And now, having said that, I think the other side is perfectly within their right to produce their long-form ads and air them wherever and, you know, whenever they can. But it's interesting you brought this up because that, you know, as I was on my way over here, when I was being told that our television viewing of our film the night before the election may be canceled is because, in part, of the pressure and the controversy that surrounded the Sinclair Broadcasting airing of this anti-Kerry piece, that they're afraid now of the White House, the Republican Party, coming after them. And I don't know why it is always, it seems on our side, the knees are pretty weak, and the first sign of trouble or pressure or a phone call from just one person, and then suddenly everyone starts to cave. The other side, you know, they're not like that at all. They're like, damn it, you know, we're going to air this, we're going to put it on 62 stations, and to hell with you. And, you know, you can see why they win a lot of times.
I'm interested in hearing how the film has changed your life and how you see yourself. I mean, I would have thought of you before as not being all that interested in voting booth politics. I would, you know, I may be totally off track here, but I would have thought that you would have conceived of voting booth politics as being kind of mainstream and not really changing things much one way or another. And now, you know, you are working so actively to register people to vote in this election. You think this election is really quite important. Is that a recent change in your life?
Yes and no. I mean, I've always voted, and I've always been interested in electoral politics. I was the first 18-year-old elected to public office in Michigan when 18-year-olds were given the right to vote back in 1972.
What was the
school
office?
Board. I ran. It was in the last couple months of my senior year in high school, and I ran for the school board and got elected. But, you know, the same week I got elected to the school board, I was also elected class clown by my fellow seniors in high school. So, you know, there's always been those two parts of me. To be honest, the night I shot that the scene in the movie with the mother from Flint, Lila Lipscomb, who lost her son Michael in the war, and we were sitting in her living room, and she brought out his last letter home to her, and she starts to read the letter, and I'm sitting there behind the camera, and I'm listening to this letter, and then he comes to this part where he's talking about, you know, just what the heck are we doing over here? This is crazy. And he essentially makes his last request in this letter, hoping that the American people do not, in his words, return that fool to the White House. And I broke down. I'm trying not to let her see me. I'm like, you know, back behind the camera, and I'm just... I have a 23-year-old. You think about, what if this were your child? And why her child? Why did her child have to die? And I just remember thinking right then, as I was listening to this, and it also got me just to sort of stop crying, was basically, all right, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to honor this man's last request. I am now going to do, you know, whatever I can do to stop this man in the White House.
Well, right now, you're on a tour trying to register young people to vote. You're calling it the Slacker Uprising Tour. What's your technique?
Well, I'm embracing them, first of all. I do not criticize them for being slackers, for being lazy, for not voting. I come to these, to each city, and we've been having these huge turnouts, 10, 12, 15,000 people, coming out, in places like Reno, Nevada and Gainesville, Florida. And, basically I say to them, you know, I'm here to honor your slacker ways. If you believe all politicians suck, don't change that viewpoint. It's a good place to be. Just stay right there. You know, I don't want you to get up out of the lazy boy, except for just maybe 10 minutes on November 2nd. And here's why. And then I give the reasons why. And then I ask people in the arena who, especially people over the age of 22 who did not vote in the last election, or maybe people, older people who've never voted in their lives, to please stand. And then it's an amazing sight. You see hundreds of people stand. And then I asked them if they would be willing to pledge in front of these thousands of people that they will vote in this election. I will give them their choice of door prizes here. A week's supply of the sustenance of slackers everywhere, ramen noodles. For the guys, a clean pair of underwear. I have offered to go and clean their dorm rooms on college campuses, do their laundry, whatever it takes. So that they don't have to change their slacker ways, but if they will promise to me that they will get out and vote, that's how far I'm willing to go for them.
Now, are you still being sued for this by the by the Michigan Republican Party?
Well, it wasn't a suit. They actually filed a criminal complaint against me.
I see.
with prosecutors in four counties in Michigan. Because, you know, you cannot bribe people to vote. I mean, you can't offer people like money or whatever to vote. Now, one thing in each of these events every night, I don't ask them who they're voting for. And
does that protect you from criminal charges?
Well, see, I'm just working out my defense line right now. That's right. Okay. They're I don't know. You know, I haven't been back to Michigan yet. I don't know if I'm on the lam here or not. But I did read one of the prosecutors said that he was too busy trying to keep guns and cocaine out of the hands of young people in not clean underwear. In fact, as a parent, he was happy that Michael Moore was getting the college kids to change their underwear.
Your life has changed a lot in the past few years. You know, your image is the working class guy from Flint, Michigan, but let's face it, your books and your movies have made you quite wealthy. Is there a disconnect in your life between the persona of Michael Moore and the reality of how Michael Moore lives or is capable of living now that you're truly a wealthy man?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when you grow up working class, it's like if you grow up Catholic, even if you don't go to Mass every Sunday, you know, you really are always Catholic. You know, it just doesn't leave you. And it's the same thing, you know, growing up, you know, the son of a man who worked on the assembly line at General Motors. That person is still the same person. If you knew me before this and you knew me now, you'd see the same person who, you know, sort of thinks and acts and behaves the same way. And, you know, I'm still have my same friends and, you know, still married to the same woman and just, you know, have the basic same life I had beforehand. The difference is that people have decided to buy my books and go to my movies. And that has generated income. To be honest, the more it's happened, the more responsibility I feel. And it becomes even a greater burden. You know, what am I going to do? Are you doing enough, Mike? You know, I mean, these are the questions I ask myself. And because I was raised with this in this Irish Catholic household, with a belief system that was, you know, instilled in me and one that I subscribe to this day, that, you know, we will be judged by how we treat the least among us. I believe that. And so it's very important for me to make sure that, you know, I give a large chunk of the money to things I believe in and then put the money into the work I do so I can continue the work and feel blessed and privileged as a result of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Moore, and his film Fahrenheit 9/11 has just been released on DVD. He also has a new book called The Official Fahrenheit 9/11 Reader and another book called Will They Ever Trust Us Again? Letters from the War Zone. Some of the footage in Fahrenheit 9/11 comes from American reporters and reporters around the world. This is footage that we hadn't, I'm referring now to footage we hadn't seen before, say, on network TV news. I'm wondering if you spoke to a lot of reporters who expressed any frustration that they had footage that they couldn't actually use because, for whatever reason.
Well, I you know, look, there are good people that work at all the, in all the network news departments and, on our daily papers, and some of them do have a very hard time getting the story out. And I've been fortunate in recent years because they know of me and my work, where they will slip me tapes or you know, information or whatever that they're having a hard time getting out there. Now, obviously, I cannot, you know, tell you specifically which scenes in the movie that this relates to because I don't want to get anyone in trouble. But it's interesting you bring up this question because it is the number one thing that I hear from people, either after they, you know, leave the movie or people who've emailed me after seeing the movie. The number one thing I hear are not comments about, oh, that George W. Bush, I can't stand him. That is not the number one thing I hear. The number one thing I hear is, how come I didn't see that scene ever? And that, you know that one scene? You know that scene where the black congressmen aren't allowed to speak, you know, when they were verifying the Florida vote there in Congress? Or the Inauguration Day riot that took place where Bush's limousine was pelted with eggs. I never saw that on the nightly news. No one saw it. None of us saw any of this stuff. And that's the question people, I mean, the movie, in a way that I didn't really intend, ended up outing our mainstream media.
There's a scene in which we see an injured Iraqi on a stretcher. And he is I don't know how to phrase this exactly. Why don't you give it a go?
Yeah. Right. This is one of the scenes that was shot by one of our freelancers. The Army had gone in, U.S. Army had gone in, and rounded up a bunch of Iraqi citizens in a village early one morning, and they were holding them. They were trying to find, they thought one of them might have been, you know, one of the insurgents, and there was an elderly man that had a bad knee, and so they put him on a stretcher, and he had a blanket over him. And for whatever reason, he started to get, you know, he had an erection. And you could see it clearly through the blanket. And the soldiers saw this, and they decided to have some fun with it. And they took turns touching the erection through the blanket and humiliating him. At the same time, the other soldiers were putting bags and hoods over the detainees' heads. And then they would stand there and pose for photos, putting their arms around the detainees while the bags were over their heads to send home. I think one said he was going to make a Christmas card out of it or whatever.
What was the state of that footage before you got your hands on it? Like, I know you don't want to tell us who gave it to you, but what can you tell us about how you found that footage?
No, I can tell you. I can tell you because he was one of the freelancers that we were using to gather footage there. His name is Irvin Hamid, and he is part Iraqi and part Swedish. He was shooting the footage, and after he shot it, he was trying to get it on, trying to give it to various networks who wouldn't take it. Now, this happened in December of 2003, so this is a few months before the whole Abu Ghraib thing, broke. And he wasn't getting anywhere with it. And then, finally, this is the point then where we hooked up with him the first time. And he gave it to us, and we decided to put a portion of it in the film.
Your film is such an example of how divided America is now. The people who are so passionate about your movie, who've seen it several times, so many people coming to your screenings and to your Slacker tour in which you're trying to register young people to vote. At the same time, there's an industry that's grown around attacking you, and a lot of people who aren't part of that industry, just like film critics and journalists, many of them, there's been a considerable amount of criticism leveled by them at your film. So I thought I would just read an excerpt of one critical thing. And this is somebody who is not a professional partisan. This is a comment from Scott Simon of NPR. And this was from an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. So here's a couple of lines from that. Trying to track the unproven innuendos and conspiracies in a Michael Moore film or book is as futile as trying to count the flatulence jokes in one by Adam Sandler. He goes on to say, in what is perhaps the most wrenching scene in the film, an Iraqi woman is shown wailing amid the rubble caused by a bomb that killed members of her family. I do not doubt her account or her sorrow. I have interviewed Iraqis about U.S. bombs that killed civilians. People who agree to wars should see the human damage bombs can do. But reporters who were taken around to see the sites of civilian deaths during the bombing of Baghdad also observed that some of those errant bombs were fired by Iraqi anti-aircraft crews. Mr. Moore doesn't let the audience know when and where this bomb dropped, or otherwise try to identify the culprit of the tragedy. What's your reaction to that?
I read that when he wrote that, and I just thought, where is this man's heart? That was my first thought. To compare what he calls the few errant missiles being fired by Iraqi artillery against what the New York Times told us this summer, that of the first 50 airstrikes when we started bombing Iraq, we were 0 for 50 in hitting our intended target. 0 for 50. Who do you think then got hit? Who do you think died? We killed thousands of civilians as a result of our bombing. And that mother that comes out of the rubble there, and frankly, it ultimately really doesn't matter which bomb hit her family. The fact that there had to be any missile or bomb at all, who's responsible for that? Who is responsible for that? I'm responsible for that. You're responsible for that. We pay our taxes. We helped to pay for those bombs, or we created a situation where the Iraqis had to try and defend themselves. And when she comes out of that rubble and calls upon God to curse all of us for killing her family, I'll tell you, every time I see that scene, it's piercing. It just pierces me. And it, because I believe on some level we are cursed. We are cursed through our actions.
One last question. As you travel around the country, does it feel to you that America is divided in a way that it's never been before? And you, reaction to you is just, you know, one example of that division.
No, it's always been divided ever since I was a kid. So it was divided with the civil rights movement. It was divided with the women's movement. It was divided with the Vietnam War.
I should also say that a lot of people would say your film is an example. Your film is an example of that division. A lot of people would say.
You know what they mean? When they say the country's divided, mm-hmm. or the film is an example of that division, mm-hmm. what they're really saying is that liberals for decades now have not fought back. They're fighting back this time. They're standing up and being counted. And this film goes right after the man sitting in the Oval Office, and does so in throughout most of the film in his own words. And I think it feels more polarized or more divisive, or, you know, the anger or whatever that seems to be there now is only because we've just gone through 20-plus years of Republican, right-wing, Christian conservative, you know, they've sort of set the agenda. Even when a Democrat like Clinton was in office, you know, they set the agenda, and that he essentially, in many ways, had to follow or adjust, you know, with his way. But now liberals are fighting back, and I think that people are kind of like, whoa, what's happening? Oh, now there's all this divisiveness. You know, I think it's good. I think it's healthy. I think it's always great in a democracy when you've got strong viewpoints, people stand up for what they believe in. I'll say this. I'm of the belief that anyone who engages in the debate, whether they're liberal or conservative, I believe they're engaged because they love their country. I would never make the accusation that the other side, simply because I don't agree with them, are somehow un-American or hate, you know, they hate their country. I don't think they hate their country at all. I think they love their country, and they have a certain roadmap that they wish the country would follow. Finally, we're hearing from the other side, and it's why it's very funny listening to the conservatives complaining about, you know, well, it's not, you know, it's not fair and balanced. We're, you know, that his film's out there, and so now, you know, you should put our film out there. These are the same people that got rid of the fairness doctrine, because and after they did, they took over AM radio, and now when our side finally rises out of its slumber, they're all like, you know, why can't we all just get along? Why do we have to have all this polarization? You know, it only feels that way because we've taken enough of it, and we're not going to take it anymore, and we're going to remove this man from the White House.
Michael Moore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Moore's movie Fahrenheit 9/11 is out on video and DVD. His new books are The Official Fahrenheit 9/11 Reader and Will They Ever Trust Us Again? Letters from the War Zone.